Well, you had an opportunity today to show how much it meant to you to be in an assembly of Christians with all this football and basketball going on the unhappy collocation of all those events with the first day of the week. But it's good. Have to suffer every now and then. Have to let the Lord know that it means something to be here in His presence and to be with other Christians. We're delighted for every visitor. Glad you're here. Glad for the return of some who've been away. Tonight I want to begin a brief series on one of the most remarkable books of the whole of the Scripture. Remarkable not because it contains superlative truths, that is, truths that surpass everything else that is in the revelation of God, but remarkable because of the approach that is made and the way it challenges us to think. This book has been the source of the greatest aggravation to Bible scholars. And it seems to me that it has suffered about as much at the hands of conservative students of the Scripture as at the hand of the very liberal ones. And I'm talking about the book of Ecclesiastes. I think I may have spoken on this subject in a special series years ago. I'm not sure that it took place while I was here. I'd have to check the record. It may have been done before. And since those days, some years ago, I've had occasion to think even more about this rather remarkable book. And we can begin it today in a happy connection with what we talked about this morning, because this book is about finding out what life is really all about. There's an expression that I think is rather archaic. I heard it when I was young. People would say that a certain effort was simply not worth the candle. And, of course, that harkens back to the day before electricity, when if you did something in the dark, it was going to cost you the price of a candle to light your way. And so people would say, well, it wasn't worth the investment that it took. You don't want to live your life so that it is not worth the investment that you made. In other words, you get through, and the time is exhausted, and it's cost you everything, and you don't have anything. I'm beginning tonight the study by calling attention to the fact that the world of the writer of Ecclesiastes is the world from the vantage point of the third chapter of Genesis. It is a world that has been turned to emptiness, to vanity. And so when we began the book, that's what it says. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. If I were to ask people at random in the city of Louisville what they thought would make life successful, what they thought would make life worthwhile, I have no doubt that I could anticipate the answers. Some would talk about achieving wealth, and some would talk about achieving knowledge and education and skill. Some would talk about pleasure, happiness. Others would talk about power, position, honorable position, of course. Achieving something. Humankind simply have not changed in all these centuries since this book was written. And it's astonishing to me when I think about it. We usually compare ourselves rather happily with the lesser creatures of this world who don't seem to have sense enough to learn anything from their experience. Who cannot collect the experiences of their kind and put them down in a book so that future generations will build on that and cultures will be developed that are as a result of all the wisdom that's gathered together. Horses don't do that. Not even in Kentucky. Cattle don't do that. But human beings have the capacity for it. But we don't use it. We go through the same idiot procedures over and over again. With every generation. When we could learn so much. And especially from the Word of God. It's frequently said the Bible's outdated. And if it's not said, it is implied. And I can tell you that across this city, most people, even a lot of them that go to church, rather feel as though it's a nice book, and it's a wonderful book, and it's a really interesting book, and it's a special book. But in many ways, it doesn't speak to people in the late 20th century, almost 21st century. That, my friend, is absolute nonsense. It speaks perfectly to us. Now, it won't tell you about how to get rich materially. It won't tell you how to get the finest kind of worldly-wise education. And the curriculum for that kind of education won't be in here. Worldly-wise education. But what it will tell you is that those things are not worth the candle if you make that what your life is about. If you choose those things for your ultimate value. Now let me begin tonight by talking about who wrote Ecclesiastes and why I believe it is important to determine who wrote it. Now, I want to say at the outset that we've got a lot of books in the Bible, we're not sure who wrote them. And yet we believe, and I think with justifiable cause, that they are the words of God. I don't know who wrote 1st and 2nd Kings. Maybe you do. Or 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Perhaps you've got an idea. Some have thought that they knew. They've made some educated guesses. I don't know who wrote the Judges. The book of Judges. I'm not certain who wrote the book of Ruth or Esther or several others. And I don't know that it's particularly materially important that we know who wrote these books. But I believe it is significant to determine who wrote this chronicle of a man's experiences in seeking answers to the ultimate question. And who that man is, therefore, becomes important in the validity of his answer. The book is called in the Hebrew Bible Kohelet. It is the book of Kohelet. That is the Hebrew word which is translated in Ecclesiastes as the preacher. Ecclesiastes is the Greek term that was applied to this book, and I think you can hear within that word the more familiar word from Greek that we have heard about a lot in talking about church. Ecclesia. We only have it in English in the high-blown word ecclesiastical. But that word is talking about someone who calls to gather the assembly. Who is a master of an assembly. And therefore, it is translated in a lot of versions, the preacher. The words of the preacher. And so he identifies himself. A lot of very conservative scholars do not believe that we know who wrote this book. And I understand, as I make my own judgments tonight, that it will fly in the face of some very, very well-informed people. Even Brother Haley, who is quite a student of the Old Testament. But I believe that the text of the book makes it rather clear who Kohelet is. It says in the first verse that he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now that means he's descended from the line of David, that he is king, and that his throne is placed in the city of Jerusalem. In the same chapter, verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, which means that he was not a king of the divided kingdom. He is king over Israel, the whole of the nation. In verse 16, he says, I have gotten me great wisdom above all that were before me in Jerusalem. Now that has to tell us something too. And then finally, chapter 2 and verse 9, so I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Now there's only one man who can fit all these qualifications, and that's Solomon. And I must tell you that up until the time of Martin Luther, nobody ever questioned the Solomonic authorship of Ecclesiastes. The Hebrew tradition is without exception that Solomon wrote it. But there have been objections that have been raised. First of all, that his name is never specifically mentioned here. Well, I don't know how more specific you could get than the descriptions that are given here of the one who's writing the book, even though his name may not be mentioned. It is said about chapter 1, verse 12, that he says he was king in Jerusalem. And so Solomon could not have written it because he didn't abdicate. He couldn't have written it in his lifetime and say he was king. Well, let me say to you that we often use that past tense to describe a condition that existed at a particular point and still is true. I have said to people about a certain incident in my life, I was married then. That does not mean that I am not married now. It is describing the condition at the time of these events. At the time this great pilgrimage, this great search was made, and I believe that is not sufficient to object to his having written it. Some have said, well, no, you couldn't have these ungodly conditions existing described in Ecclesiastes, all kinds of horrible injustices going on, righteous people being treated abominably. You couldn't have all that in the time of Solomon. Well, yes, you could. As a matter of fact, in the latter part of the reign of Solomon, he was the oppressor. And the burdens that he placed upon the people, finally, as a consequence of the stupidity of his son Rehoboam, who did not realize that needed to be released, finally divided the nation asunder. 1 Kings 12:4, speaking to Rehoboam, the people said, your father made our yoke grievous. Well, what are the other possibilities? Well, then we just admit that it is true that the writer here is suggesting that he is Solomon, but he's not really Solomon. But he's using that as a literary device to try to get people to listen to what he's got to say. Let me tell you that there's something about that just doesn't ring honest with me. If the man is suggesting that he's Solomon, but wants you to understand that he's really not Solomon, then what's the use? What's the value of somebody other than Solomon writing a book that depends upon the experience of the man who writes it? That's my problem. So if Solomon wrote, or if the writer wrote under Solomon's name to deceive, he's a liar. And if he wrote so as to deceive no one, then the device added no force at all to what he had to say. On the other hand, if, as I believe is true, Solomon did write this book, there's a great power in the witness. Because he lived it. And he, in a remarkable and unique way, lived it. We ask the question as we think about Solomon, how could a man like Solomon have fallen so far? We think about what he had been, the son of David, who was a remarkable man. We think about his wise youth. We think about the request he made in his prayer at Gibeon that he should rule with wisdom rather than to ask for wealth for himself. He saw the glory of God descend upon the temple which he built during his reign. He experienced so many things that were the powerful manifestations of the greatness of the Almighty. And you would think that a man who had that kind of background could never, ever be deceived by the devil, drawn into the kind of apostasy that we know did occur. Think about what he wrote. Proverbs 3:5-6. These words live in the hearts of all who have studied the Scripture. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean not upon your own understanding, and he will direct your paths. Proverbs 4:23. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it, life issues. Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before a fall, and a haughty spirit before destruction. How did Solomon fall? Let me tell you, Solomon's apostasy was not an intellectual apostasy. That's our problem. We think that all apostasy has to be intellectual. The people get twisted up in their minds about things, and they get confused about what the truth is. They go to school at the wrong place and get the wrong kind of education and get the wrong information, and that's not true. People go to school in places that are ungodly and come out of it more godly than ever because they wanted to at the beginning, and they were committed to it in the first place, and it never changed. And people go to some little podunk school with its secularist mentality, and they make the most bland kind of presentation of worldly wisdom, and these people fall over on their noses, leave the Lord. And it's because they had a different agenda. Solomon didn't fall away because in his mind he thought these idols really were gods. He didn't fall away because he came to be convinced that this low-minded stupidity, these pagan religions had any real validity. That wasn't it. You've got to face that fact. His apostasy was affectional, not intellectual. 1 Kings 11. And Solomon loved many foreign women. What you want to be careful of is not having somebody twist your mind up, but having the devil twist up your emotions so that you want to believe what you know is incredible. And you will act like it's right simply because not to do so will cost you a relationship that you treasure above all else. And don't ever believe that the devil can't get you there. Solomon warns us about that. 1 Kings 11, verse 4, where it came to pass when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. Why is his witness so powerful? Because his own experience gives credibility. John says, in the beginning of the first epistle of John, that which we have heard, that which we have seen with our eyes, that which we have beheld and our hands have handled. Now that's stated by somebody who really experienced it, and his testimony is powerful because of that. And so the testimony of a Solomon is powerful because he lived it. And he experienced all these things. What Ecclesiastes is, I believe, is Solomon's pilgrimage in search of himself, in search of life's meaning, as later recorded and evaluated. I believe, as Ecclesiastes 12, verse 11 says, that he was guided by the Holy Spirit as he wrote these things down. These are not just the recorded meanderings of man who kept on looking in various dark corners for the reality of life and didn't find it and said a lot of nonsensical things while he was there. I think he means every word he says as he goes through this book, and that his conclusion does not change from the beginning to the last word. His conclusion at the beginning is vanity, vanities, everything is vanity. And that is his conclusion in chapter 12. Chapter 1 says it, chapter 12 says it, it never altered. Whatever he's talking about. It doesn't cease to be vain and empty in his mind when he's through with this book any more than it was at the beginning. The real question you can ask is this book the product of a late repentance about which we have no information? I admit to you that that's my greatest problem, because we don't have any record that Solomon ever repented, do we? And yet I will admit to you that if this is the work of Solomon, that Solomon at some time had to have repented, this is not the work of a young man. This is not the work of someone who hadn't been down the road. This is the work of an old man who has experienced something rather profoundly and has come to some distinct and profoundly held conclusions about it. And he wants so much to convey that to young people. This is a book for young people. If you wonder, my young friend, if any of the Bible is written to you, well, it's all written to you. But some of it, I think, is especially written to you. There's much of Proverbs that's written to young people. And Solomon is concerned there. And I will have to tell you that you've got the same problem with Proverbs that you had with Ecclesiastes. And that's how this man could have written some of these things before all this happened. Maybe he did. But I accept my problems. And I think they are lighter ones than the ones that are borne by people who say he didn't write. And I do not choose to call people who think Solomon didn't write this book as apostates. I'm not taking that position, although when I first heard a man in my graduate school days take that position, I thought he was indeed the absolute voice of apostasy in that school. He had just come from Hebrew Union University, and I knew good and well that he had just come down with the latest liberalism. Well, I've changed my mind about that, but not about who wrote this book. Solomon does not write like a philosopher. If you're trying to find some deep philosophical work here in Ecclesiastes, you're going to be mistaken and disappointed. He doesn't write like a Stoic, because the Stoics didn't believe in enjoying life. Diogenes, you know, the way you enjoy life is to have very few expectations and very few needs, and therefore you can't be disappointed very much if you didn't expect much. This book doesn't talk about avoiding joyful experiences. He's not an Epicurean, on the other hand, because he believes in divine judgment and speaks about it quite often. At the very end of the book, he said, for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. He doesn't come as a pagan to the question, what is the meaning of life, because he believes in God, knows his commandments, speaks of worshiping him. For which cause, you read this book and you know you're dealing with a Hebrew sage who begins with the presupposition that God exists and that God has worked in the affairs of men and that he has expectations of us, that he expects us to live in certain ways, and that indeed that's something we're going to have to wrestle with. Well, sometimes in my preaching, by my introductions, I kill the whole thing, and I don't want to do that. And maybe I've already trembled on the edge of doing it already. Now, let's move to the book and the message of it. And I want to tell you that we are going in an overview, in a measure here, to get you ready for this. Key expressions in the book. This won't be news to anybody that's studied the book. Under the sun. That's a key expression. And it means the physical world, the world of the tangible. The things we can see, the visible world. Things down here.
And when he says that things under the sun are without value, ultimate value, he's telling you the truth. There is nothing here you can hold in your hand or see with your eye that is worth everything. It's vanity. And by vanity, he means temporary, transient, only here for a little while. Build your life on that, and the foundation be ripped right out from under you. Striving after the wind is another expression that he uses often. Some translations give it feasting on the wind or chasing the wind. It just means you're eating air. You're not going to get anything out of this. There's nothing substantial here. It doesn't have any ultimate value. And you notice that that's his theme from beginning to end, as I said before. He pounds all this visible world into utter dust. And when he gets through, there's not anything left. So far as he's concerned, not any of it can provide a foundation for true success or happiness or meaning. Not any of it. And more than that, he will tell you it was never intended to do that, especially in the condition which God left it after man turned away from it. The book of Ecclesiastes answers two questions. The first question is, what is life's ultimate purpose? You and I are going to have to ask that question, and we're going to have to get an answer or lose it all. No, let me say it a different way. We're going to have to get the right answer or lose it all. But there's a second question, I think, in the book, and that is admitting that this life, this world, this physical existence, this life here under the sun is transient, temporary, and you can't build anything on it. How should we live in a world like that? And how should we interact with that kind of world? That's a practical question. And I think Solomon deals with that question, too, in this book. Now, that it's amazing how rapidly you can get through a transparency when you need to. Now, let's look further at the book's purpose. The purpose of the book, I believe, is to prepare men to listen to God. You know, we don't come to that easily. We'll run all over the country looking for something that pleases us and that we can say we found, and that's the answer, before we'll sit down and ask the obvious person, the one who created all this, the one who's responsible for it, the one who alone knows why he did it. Before we'll ask him the question, before we'll take counsel from him, we'll seek it in a lot of places. This book is intended to prepare us to listen to God and to trust him and to seek profit where? Not under the sun, but above the sun. Now, we'll get into the text of the book briefly tonight. What he says in the beginning, in that first chapter, going down to about verse 15, is there's nothing new under the sun. And he gives expression of that absence of any purpose. And that's what he's talking about. He said there doesn't seem to be any purpose. Everything goes on the same endless cycle. And what does he mention here? He says in verse 4, one generation goes, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, hastes to its place where it arises. The wind goes toward the south and turns about to the north and turns about continually in its course, and the wind returns again to its circuits, and all the rivers run to the sea. Yet the sea is not full, and to the place where the rivers go, thither they go again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Now you understand here that Solomon is not taking a naturalist view. He's not saying to you, you ought never to find any pleasure in the views of the natural world. My brother and sister, God created beautiful things because he made us to appreciate them. And we need them. And so it's an answer to what we are. But that's not his perspective here. You've got to keep in mind that Solomon is searching for the ultimate thing. And I'll tell you, the ultimate thing will not be found in sitting out in the glories of nature. You're wonderful to be there. I stand in awe of the wonders of the Grand Canyon. But I never got an answer out there to the ultimate purpose of life. And I don't care where you go in the whole sphere or if you get into the stratosphere. Whatever you see and whatever you experience, you will never get an answer. There will be plenty there that will tell you that there is a God because the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows His handiwork. But having established that, that's as far as you will go. And the ultimate question about why God put us here, that you won't get. But what he's talking about here is this endless cycle that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Verse 9, that which hath been, that which shall, is that which shall be, and that which hath been done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. And usually people get hold of that and they say, well, I know that's not true. I mean, they didn't have electricity when I was a boy. That's new. That's not new. I mean, God made that a long time ago. That's just man's utilization of what's been here all the time. We're talking about something intrinsically new. Something fundamentally new, totally and absolutely new. We're not talking about something like the atomic bomb. That's just utilization of something that's been going on in this physical world a long, long time. I'll tell you how much we've influenced the world. We think we've done so much, we've gone to the moon. We've had about as much influence as a race during the whole length of our existence on this universe as a gnat flying over the world would have when he dropped an eyelash. That's about it. Nothing has changed. The course of the wind's the same. The weather, same pattern. And from the viewpoint under the sun, without any information beyond that, this looks like an endless cycle of the same old thing going nowhere. You know, the Greeks had the idea that history was a constantly repeated circle. The Bible is unique in some ways in that it presents history as something moving to a designed end, to a designed purpose. It starts here, it ends and concludes here. That is not the view of history that men who have searched out by their own philosophy to find out what life's about. They come to the conclusion it's just endless repetition, like a man lost in the snow. Or as Shakespeare says in one of his plays, a tale told by an idiot. Idiot signifying nothing. It is going nowhere. Has no meaning. And I want to tell you, if you're going to try to get your answers from under the sun, that is exactly the kind of answer you're going to get. Endless futility. Endless cycles of nature. And the reason that is true is because the creation has been subjected to vanity. That's what Paul said in Romans 8, verse 20. And I think in that passage when he said that the world was subjected to vanity, he's talking about what God did. And God did it when Adam and Eve decided they didn't want to do His will. And He cast them out. And disease and death and decay became the order of the day, and the world that God created in the beginning is not the world of Genesis 3. The world of Genesis 1 and 2 is not the world of Genesis 3. And what Solomon is talking about here is the world of Genesis 3. He's not talking as a Jew so much as he's talking as a man. What men have to do with their lives. And so, it's a world that's become, well, puzzling. A lot of puzzles in this world. Why did God do that? I believe the answer is in 1 Corinthians 1:21. You remember what that says? Paul's talking about two kinds of wisdom in 1 Corinthians. The kind that the Corinthians had let themselves get wrapped up in, and the kind that they had originally committed themselves to. And he says, for seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God. It was God's good pleasure through the foolishness of the thing preached, the preaching, to save them that believe. What it means is you can just study all you want to. Fill your mind full of science. And when you draw a line and sum it all up, you still don't know the first thing about why this universe exists. And what is more valuable than anything else and will be transcendently valuable in that everything here can end and still it'll be standing. You don't get that from study. Science? Not possible. And so God arranged it this way. That's what this says. That men who tried to penetrate the universe and find the secret behind it were going to fail. They would not find God by searching after Him. The only way you can find God is to listen and let Him come to you and tell you what life is about. That's the preaching. That's the gospel. But oh, we don't like that answer. Because we don't get any credit after that's over. We can't congratulate ourselves about how smart we were to figure that out. How wise and shrewd we were to have penetrated all these mysteries and put it together so that we're the heroes. We're not the heroes in any sense. So, let me tell you what you've got here in Ecclesiastes that can sound, when you first read it, as being rather cynical and maybe a little bit hard. And you might even think not true, but believe me, it's true. Ecclesiastes 2, 14 and 15. The wise man's eyes are in his head. That means he's got it together. And the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceive that one event happens to them all. They both die. And from this perspective under the sun, you can't tell whether it was good to be wise or good to be a fool. Well, it helps out for the time. But in the ultimate sense, you can't tell whether the wise man prevailed over the fool. Because both of them come to the same end, and that's death. And before they die, they're liable to get sick. And while they're sick, they're going to suffer. Wise man and fool alike. Now, Solomon's not telling you something that's not true. He's not some old cynic that's had a bad time of it and turned sour on life. He's telling you the way it is. And it'll always be that way. Well, in this case, it will always be that way. Everybody's going to die. Chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. For that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yes, they have all one breath, and man has no preeminence above the beast, for all is vanity. Now, that's where we have trouble. We say, well, Solomon, wait a minute. Now, that's the reason that many people have come to this book and said, now, he's got to be out of his mind right here. This is one of those times when he's kind of gone crazy and gone off on this wild tangent, and he's saying these things that are just not sane. They're not true. Yes, they are, if you take his perspective, under the sun. From what you know from under the sun, tell me, what is the difference between a dog and a man? They do both have the same physical breath. And you cannot tell from anything you could establish scientifically that one was different than the other, except one has a greater intelligence than the other. But both of them die, and as this man says, who can tell whether the spirit of one goes up and the other one goes down? As for life under the sun, if you don't know something more than what you can find out here under the sun from this physical world, that's the way it is. And that challenges us, does it not? And then another from chapter 7 and verse 15. All this have I seen in my days of vanity. There is a righteous man that perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongs his life in his evil doing. Now, tell me that's not true. I don't know why Saddam Hussein gets to live on and off. I don't know. And yet I know some godly people whose lives are pure and earnest, who seem to know nothing but pain from beginning to end. Why is that? Job continues to be a challenge to us. We got background information that Job didn't get, and the Lord never revealed to him. We found out what was going on behind the scenes. But I'll tell you something you still do not know after you've read the book of Job, why he suffered. Well, you say, well, it was this contest thing. Yes, but why did God allow Job to suffer? What was the purpose of his suffering? God does all things for our good. What good was there in it for Job? We say, well, he needed to be cleansed of something, and that may be right, but God did not say that to him. The only thing God said to Job was, you're going to have to trust me. We've been studying Jeremiah. The last question I ask as we came to the conclusion of that book is, do you think God loved Jeremiah? A young, fine young Jew from a priestly family who at age 30 would take up his task in the regular rotation in the temple and serve in the very presence of the living God. The only thing is, he never had the privilege.
What he was given was the task of preaching a message which was to the nation of the late 7th century B.C. a horrible...
Well, it was the ultimate in treachery. To call upon the people of God to go out and meet their enemy and give up and let him carry them away to captivity. And everybody hated him. His own townspeople tried to kill him. He was the subject of one plot after another, and he was the object of abuse continually. He was the one dark figure in the nation that was the object of hatred, and he felt it keenly. He needed somebody to tell his troubles to, but the Lord said, "You cannot marry." Well, surely something good happened. No. Not in this life under the sun. His last days were spent in Egypt, where he was carried against his will by some ungodly men who were told not to do it. And he's the one that told them. Did God love him? And the answer is, yes. But how do you know something from above the sun has come to us to let us know that God does? But I want to tell you something. In this life, the righteous don't always prosper, and the wicked don't always suffer. In fact, Solomon says sometimes it is the very opposite of that. In verse 14 of chapter 8, there is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there are righteous men unto whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said this also is vanity. Now the question is, why did God do this? I believe it's in chapter 3 and verse 14 that the answer is. And by the way, that third chapter of Ecclesiastes is not telling you that there's a time to kill and a time to die and time. That there is a time when you need to choose this. When it is the moment when you need to do that. He's telling you that's how life is. It jerks you around. And that in this life there are all kinds of jarring contradictions. And you can't work them out, just like he told you in the first chapter. You can't make the things that are crooked straight. You can't penetrate the mystery by your own intellectual prowess. You can't do that. And now, why has God made it so? In verse 10 he says, after that very familiar phrase, a very familiar passage, "I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. He hath made everything beautiful in its time. Also he hath set eternity in their heart, yet so that men cannot find out the work that God had done from the beginning even then." What did 1 Corinthians 1:21 say? That men in their wisdom cannot know God. "I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good as long as they live, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor is the gift of God." We'll come to that later. "I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God hath done it that men should fear before him." The purpose of this book is to prepare men to listen to God. Now we come to the end. Why is it? You look at those passages, and all of them talk about fearing God. God's going to bring us to our intellectual knees and force us to recognize we don't have the answers. And that our efforts to find those answers through our own probing and our own wisdom are destined to fail until anybody that's got sense at last falls upon his knees and says, "God, give me the answers. I'm ready to listen." Why all this world of mysteries and contradictions, that is, from our vantage point under the sun, so that we would reverence and obey God? And my friend, you and I need to have that spirit of reverential awe toward him. You're not going to be able, and I think this lesson is obvious in Ecclesiastes, you're not going to be able to rationalize your world, that is, to bring it into some sort of formula so that you can predict exactly what's going to happen about things. And you know why it happens, and you've got all the ends put together so that everything makes a perfect whole, and there are no paradoxes. You're not going to do that. You're going to get answers from one place alone, and that's from God. Well, what is the answer here? Well, the answer is, like Solomon says, we'll just anticipate that before we get through this study. Fear God and keep His commandments, for that's the whole duty of man, whether it goes good or it goes bad, whether things work out in a pleasant way or they don't work out in a pleasant way. God is still God, His truth is still truth, and it will be triumphant, and it's the only thing that will stand in the crumbling ashes of this universe, which is destined to perish. But the way of the Lord will never perish. And it's to that that we need to attach ourselves. And we need to do it now. We don't need to waste any more time with foolishness, trying to figure things out for ourselves, because we're not going to succeed in that. We're going to fail utterly. We're going to sing this hymn. All gospel preaching has the intention and the purpose to draw men to come to God. That's what we talked about here. To humble, accept the fact that God knows the way. And so as you sit in this audience tonight, consider your own situation. If you have never come to Christ and received the wisdom of the living God that comes from above the sun, then now is the time. Don't waste the rest of your life doing what Solomon did, probing here and there to find all the ultimate good and finding nothing. He's telling you, don't play the fool like I did. Learn from me. As a young man, seek God in the early days, as early as you can. Seek the Lord and do His will. That's the counsel of Solomon, and it's the counsel of the Holy Spirit, and I offer you tonight as we invite you to come to the Lord while we stand and sing.